Welcome back to the Renaissance Poop Shoot, Ray. Episode 115.
Right.
15. Yes, 15.
115.
Continuing the story of LDV, Leonardo da Vinci.
I think it's important for everyone to know that if you, and you don't have to raise your hand, you don't have to give us your name, but if you have problems finishing, you're not alone. Leonardo also had problems finishing his artwork, and I suffered financially for it.
Yeah, at the end of our last episode, we talked about that in 1477, he finally split away from Verrocchio and set up his own workshop, and it was a commercial and artistic failure.
Right.
Over the next 5 years, he got only three commissions, all of which were organized by his father, pulling strings as a favor to try and help his illegitimate bastard son out. And one of those that he never started, he did some sketches for it but never started, was supposedly for an altarpiece in the chapel of the Palazzo della Signoria. It was going to be a scene of a shepherd who comes to pay his respects to baby Jesus. He did sketches,
yeah.
Never started it, but those sketches were an inspiration for a painting that he did begin but never finished.
Right.
It's known as the most influential unfinished painting in the history of art, yeah. And it is the Adoration of the Magi,
right.
Which I have seen a number of times. It's in the Uffizi Gallery in Florence. And I've always liked it but didn't truly appreciate it until I researched it for this episode. Now I have a much better appreciation for it, and I'm looking forward to talking about it.
Yeah. I do want to ask real quick before we jump into that. So he starts his own shop at age 24 when most other students, for lack of a better word, would have already left their masters and gone on. And this is just my opinion, but I get the sense that Leonardo is like, live and let live. Unless there's a reason for me to get out, I'm not big on change. He stays with Verrocchio. He's probably having a good time. He's working for his master. He's learning a lot. And for whatever reason, at some point at a relatively late age, he decides to go out on his own. And like you said, his father is like, oh my God, what am I going to do with my teenage son who doesn't seem to be going anywhere? Can't get him to join the military. Maybe at least I can get him a couple of commissions. And if he could use his freaking talent, things might turn out well. So I think his father is just a typical dad trying to help a son who doesn't seem to have the ability to put one foot in front of the other or get any kind of discipline in him. And dad's trying to help.
Yeah, that's how I felt about you when I met you.
And how did that? Well, we probably shouldn't go into that now.
Good for you. I'm down like, you know, $1 million, but, you know, you did okay out of it.
Yeah, so thanks. Thank you. I'm trying to say
historian.
Yeah.
Historian Kenneth Clark has called Leonardo's Adoration of the Magi the most revolutionary and anti-classical picture of the 15th century.
Ooh. He's heaping big praise on this young guy.
Yeah. It was commissioned in March of 1481 by the monastery of San Donato at Scopetto, which was just outside of Florence's walls, mm-hmm. at the time. LDV was 29, and again, his father helped. He was the notary for the church. Right. He bought his firewood from them.
Thanks, Dad.
And remember that, because firewood is a big part of this story.
Yes.
His payment, the father, that is, that year for his notary work was two chickens. That's what he got paid.
But if you don't kill them, isn't that a decent amount of eggs? I don't know anything about chickens. Oscar the farmer, who can we call? Is two chickens good? Yeah. I don't know.
I raise chickens.
Did you?
I do. Yeah, I have a chicken. I have two chicken farms. In Minecraft. I think it's pretty much the same thing. You start with two. They have babies, right. If you feed them seeds, and then they lay eggs, and you pick up the eggs and you throw them at a wall.
That. Okay.
And one in every eight turns into a baby chicken. And then when the chickens are fully grown, you eventually kill them. You get some meat that you can eat, but you also get feathers occasionally, and you can use the feathers to make arrows, which you can take into the nether and kill ghasts.
Okay,
in particular, is what I need the arrows
think
for.
This is helping you in real life as much as you think it is, but as long as you're happy, because I thought you were going to say use the feathers to make pillows or something. I don't know. You lost me on that last part. But anyway, if you're happy, I'm happy.
So, yes, his father got paid two chickens, which is about what your contribution to this show has been worth over the last year. I think I'll start paying you in Minecraft chickens from now on.
I'll set up an account.
Now, there was a very elaborate contract drawn up by Leonardo's father between Leonardo and the monastery. Part of it was to paint the adoration. Another part of it was to decorate the face of a clock in the monastery.
How hard could that be? Yeah.
Yeah, not hard. Now, you would think maybe that if your father was the lawyer working for both sides to draw up this contract, that he'd look after you.
He'd tilt it.
But
yeah.
he was charging the monastery by the minute. He was getting paid in chickens. I don't know. It was like one feather a minute, I think. I'm not exactly sure what the rate was, but...
But here's the thing, though. He left and started his own workshop at 24. He's now 29. His father, as we're about to go into, makes up this elaborate semi-fail-proof contract. But the point is, it's been 5 years or 4.5 years. I'm getting the sense that Leonardo has got a reputation for not finishing these things. So the monks are like, okay, he's your son. We'll try something, but we want some guarantees. And so Leo's father has got to write in some very specific clauses so the monastery doesn't feel like they get ripped off. I mean, it's sad, but that's where Leo's at, and that's where his father's at in trying to help him.
You know, one of the questions that I had in reading through all this stuff is, okay, 5 years out of Verrocchio's studio, got three commissions, didn't start one, didn't finish the other two. Right? What the fuck was he doing for 5 years?
Maybe he, I don't know.
How did he survive?
Yeah. Oh, that's a good question. I wish we knew.
Running around sucking dick.
Maybe he kept up with Verrocchio. Maybe it took pity. I have no idea, but you're right. There's a 5-year gap that we don't know much. And how did he survive day to day? Where did he live? How did he pay rent? How did he buy food? How did he buy the dick suckers? I don't know. But the point is, how did he get by for 5 years? Unless his dad was slipping him some coin.
While he was slipping 13-year-old boys some dick. We said at the very beginning in our first episode that painting for Leonardo was like a side hustle.
Yes.
He thought of himself as a scientist, as an engineer.
Architect.
Here we are. None of the books that I've read up until this point mention him doing fuck all about science and engineering.
Right?
It's all about his art and the lack thereof that he's done. He's 29.
Get it together for God. Maybe he's still in his observing nature phase.
He's like one of these kids that never leaves university today. They just keep going back.
He keeps
doing
switching
more
his
degrees.
Major. Yeah. Yeah. He keeps getting lines.
Yeah.
But you're right. I mean, he's not engineering. He's not scientificing. He's not doing fuck all. It's about painting, and he's not even doing that.
Speaking of rich kids who keep going to university, Alex Kynaston just got accepted to do her master's in fine art.
Of course she did. Good for her. Good for
her.
One of us should do something.
We should get her on to talk about Leonardo.
Hell yeah.
I'll reach out to her.
Yeah.
Now, you never can be too careful when you're dealing with scummy artists. I'm not including Alex in that, of course. Alex is the complete opposite of scummy.
Good quality.
But, you know, I just love this situation where Piero is negotiating this contract. And I can just imagine that he's sitting with the monks at the monastery, and he's like, "Well, listen, you need to have this clause, and you need to have that clause, and you need to have the other clause." Yeah, I like this idea. So he's sitting in the room.
Right.
He's like, "Well, listen." They're like, "Well, I thought this guy's your son." Right. He goes, "Well, like right now."
Right.
I'm your lawyer.
Yeah.
He's my son after 5 p.m. And even then, he's a bastard. Right. So, you know, not really.
Exactly.
Yeah.
He's on the outs with me right now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And listen, he's got a reputation, this kid, of not finishing paintings. Right. Too busy fucking young boys up the poot chute, from what I heard. In fact, I've heard his nickname is Leonardo da Fieri.
But when he does paint, it's amazing. I haven't seen one in 5 years, but trust me, when this guy paints, it's incredible.
Oh,
you're going to thank me.
It's going to be great.
Yeah,
you're going to thank me. Now, the contract stipulated that Leonardo wasn't going to get paid with actual money.
No.
On top of that, he would have to supply his own paint and gold and any other costs.
Sure.
And the painting had to be delivered within 30 months.
Wow.
Or he wouldn't get paid and they got to keep the painting.
Oh, this is all one-sided, unless I'm not good at lawyering.
Gee, what are the chances of that?
I don't know.
What was he going to get instead of cash, dollar bill, Benjamin's Ray?
Well, I'll explain it, but it doesn't sound good for Leo. Again, his father, I think, is looking out for the monastery. So anyways, he's going to get some property given to him in his name that's near Florence that's been donated to the monastery. So that sounds impressive. It's a land. And Leo would have the right to sell it back to the monastery for 300 florins. Like we said before, 300 florins, that's nothing to sneeze at. So that's pretty cool. However, he is going to have to pay a young woman's dowry of 150 florins that has been a part of the land deal. So again, here's some land. You start making payments for this young lady, and when you're all said and done, we will buy the land back from you for $300. You're going to lose $150 over the time because you got to pay for this young woman's dowry, but you're still 150 florins ahead minus your expenses. I think for almost any other artist who is producing work regularly, this would be an insult. But for Leo, it's almost like it's a last desperate stab by his father working with the monastery to get this kid to produce and finish something and have a little bit of money to show at the end of it. To me, it's like a Big Ben. It's a last clutch ploy to get something out of this very talented but very unfocused 29-year-old.
And who was the young woman that he had to pay the dowry for?
Mary. No, I don't know. Tell me. I just assumed she was some tart. I apologize for using that word. I'm sorry.
No, she was the daughter of the man who died and donated the property to the monastery.
So look after my daughter. That makes sense.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I think the deal seems to have been either the monastery didn't have any money.
Right.
Because they weren't, getting Medici support or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Or support of any other elites. And they didn't want to give Leonardo cash if they did have it because he had this reputation for being, useless. So they were like, listen, somebody just died. They gave us this house. You can have the house, and we will buy it. Well, we reserve the right to buy it back off you when you've finished the work for 300 florins, but you've got to pay this woman's dowry and you have to pay it up front.
Yeah.
Now, he must have been, the point of this story is he must have been fucking desperate to agree to these terms. They're the shittiest terms. Now, I'm sure most artists got shitty terms.
Right.
But this is the shittiest of shitty terms.
Stinkiest. Exactly. But, like you said, three commissions in 5 years? Come on. He's at the end of his rope. So,
Yeah. Jeez. This is the greatest artist known to history, the most famous artist in the world.
Right.
At 29... he should be at the peak of his powers.
He's like a podcaster. Just nothing.
He was just a podcaster. Yeah, nothing. Working his ass off, people treat him like shit. Spends countless hours doing research, and people say, oh, you're an apologist for the Chinese government. And you're like, really? Fuck you.
Oh, God.
Now, 3 months into the project, things weren't going well. He couldn't even pay the first installment of her dowry.
Oh, sure.
And had to borrow the money from the monastery. That's he also had dipping. To borrow money from them to buy paint.
Oh, my God.
And apparently a huge barrel of wine.
But yeah.
Which we assume was for him.
Right. I'm an unemployed alcoholic. Go ahead.
But the payment that he got from them for decorating the clock was a bundle of firewood.
Well, it gets cold and you can't live by the passion of your art, or you can warm up your penis by sticking it in a young lad. But the point is you need a fire to stay warm on those cold winter nights. So
the fact that his father was getting paid in chickens from the monastery suggests that they didn't have a lot of cash.
Right.
And you know, his father bought his firewood from them, apparently. So they were paying the greatest artist in history with firewood.
Yeah.
That's like the Renaissance.
In prison, cigarettes are currency. With this monastery, besides the occasional chicken, wood and logs are their currency. That's the best they can do.
That's the Renaissance for you, baby. The greatest artist in human history getting paid in
sticks.
Firewood.
Right. So, yeah, he's got that one barrel of vermilion wine. Again, like you said, he had to borrow money for that. So that's another payment he's got to owe back to the monastery. So he hasn't produced shit, as far as we know, and he hasn't earned any money. So even into this contract, things are not looking good for him.
Now, Ray, nobody knows more about Botticelli than you. Can you, for the audience, compare... Yeah. And discuss the influence of Botticelli's adorations of the Magi with Leonardo's.
Well, not to put too fine a point on it, but I think Botticelli finished his. Oh, burn. But the point is, Botticelli was, in some ways, or at least when he had to be when it comes to religious paintings, he knew where the line was. He played it safe. Everything is... taken seriously. The wise men are treated with respect. They're, you know, they're paying their respects to little baby Jesus. But the point is, there's a lot of dignity. There's a lot of straight, stern backs and there's just a lot of, it's a moment in the religious life of Jesus where it's taken seriously, and it's a noble piece of work. For whatever reason, Leonardo was not going to go that route, but the point is Botticelli played it safe, and there's dignity in his paintings. It's well executed, but he takes it very seriously. Very reverently, I guess I should say.
And what about Leonardo?
Being Leonardo... for, I guess, maybe the way his brain works, and we've already mentioned on the previous episode that he was an outsider. He thought of himself as an outsider, and maybe he had an outsider's perspective in approaching this subject. So he's going to paint something, and he's going to attempt to paint something. He's certainly going to draw his preparatory drawings, and there's going to be a lot of detail and a lot of beauty in it, but it's not the same kind of dignity or reverence that other artists approach this with. And maybe that's just the way he saw his craft.
Botticelli painted 7 versions of the Adoration of the Magi that we know of.
Mm-hmm.
The one that we discussed, the most famous, is the one that we discussed on our Botticelli series, is the one with all of the Medici in it, old Cosimo's kneeling up, tickling baby Jesus's feet. Botticelli painted himself in it, looking like a blonde Sylvester Stallone. All of the elite are there. It is, and they're all very dignified, as you say. They're wearing their best clothes. They're mostly standing, except for the three kings that are kneeling.
Right.
The three wise men, the three kings. Joseph is there. Mary's there. Baby is like the baby's getting shot by a laser coming out of the ceiling. There's crumbled buildings in the background. They're in a crumbled barn. The crumbled building is
metaphors
to show, you know, the crumbling ages that Jesus came to replace with a brand new day. Nothing bad ever happened after Jesus came.
Nope.
Everyone lived forever. There were no more wars, no more famine, no more disease. Everyone, women dying in childbirth. It was all great. But LDV wasn't a big fan of booty. he saw Bodhi's Annunciation, not the Adoration, but the Annunciation that he painted in 1481, right. Same time Leonardo was starting his Adoration. Mm-hmm. And he wrote, "I recently saw an Annunciation in which the angel looked as if she wished to chase Our Lady out of the room with movement of such violence that she might have been a hated enemy. Damn. And Our Lady seemed in such despair that she was about to throw herself out of the window." Now, I remember this painting because we talked about it as well when we did the Bodhi series. And, right. you know, I think that's a fair thing. I mean, the angel came down and said, "Hey, bitch, God just knocked you up. Your life is over. You're fucked." It. And she's like, "Ah!" So I think that was a realistic depiction by Botticelli, but Leonardo wasn't happy with it. And he also later wrote that Botticelli makes very dull landscapes and lacks a feel for aerial perspective, painting right. both close and distant trees the same shade of green.
Oh, but threw some shade.
Boy, could he paint boobies.
So Botticelli,
that is.
He gets a pass.
Yeah. That's my commentary. LDV right. didn't write that. LDV didn't care for boobies, as we know. He was a dick man. Leonardo da Dick Man was his other nickname. Leonardo da Fairy, Leonardo da Dick Man were his two.
There was Ass Man, Kramer, and then the Dick Man.
Dick Man. Leonardo actually had a number plate. He didn't have a car, but he just wore it on his ass. Yeah. It just said Dick Man, like now, Kramer had Ass Man.
Having said that, obviously Leonardo is he might have his pride and he might not think much of Botticelli's work, but he is going to study Botticelli's versions of the Adoration of the Magi, and he's going to borrow some ideas because, you know, what did you do? Let me see if I can take what you did and make it better. And of course, with Leonardo, you know, what do you think of? You automatically think of energy, emotion, agitation in his painting. So as he's drawing, as he's making his preparatory drawings, there's going to be a lot of intensity, a lot of emotion, and it's going to look like it's like a painting supposed to. It's a picture that's been taken while these people are moving. So he's going to try to take it to the next level. Again, the point is, can he finish it? So he's starting to work on it. But again, everybody knows that there's a decent chance this guy might fall flat on his face. So the father and the monks are waiting. Is he actually going to complete this task?
Yeah, but he uses Botticelli as an inspiration. By the way, Botticelli's Adoration, the famous one that we talked about, was painted 5 or 6 years earlier.
Right.
But he uses it. I mean, he tries to paint the anti Botticelli. Right. He doesn't take it to another level. He throws it out and goes, "I'm going to do something completely different with this that no one's ever seen before."
Right, but I guess that's kind of when I say inspiration. It's like when you do something, I see what Cam has done. I'm going to do the opposite. And that's how I live my life. That's kind of what I meant. But I apologize for the confusion. Yeah, I see what you did there. I'm going to take a stage right and see if I can do something very different, but at the same time, much better than yours.
Well, certainly much more ambitious than his. Mm-hmm. Never got finished, so it's hard to say if it would have been better. But, you know, Bodhi's painting, if you're playing at home, bring up Botticelli, Adoration of the Magi. I don't recommend you Google Bodhi Adoration. That won't what you expected to. Yeah. Botticelli, Adoration of the Magi. There's about 20 or 25 characters in it. They're mostly all standing with no movement.
Yeah.
You can't see most of the bodies. You can just see a few heads and a few shoulders tucked in there. You can see maybe 10 people at the front of the painting, Mary, Joseph, and Cosimo de' Medici in the middle.
Yeah.
And they're just standing, you know, not doing anything. All their faces are pretty serene. They're like, "Oh, yeah, it's a Tuesday. There's a baby Jesus."
Yeah,
there's baby Jesus.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Well, I guess we'll just, what are you doing at 11 o'clock? I hear there's this baby Jesus meet and greet going on.
Meet me over there.
Nothing. Yeah, we'll just work along. We'll just check it out. Right. Check it out. See what's going on. Yeah. What do you reckon? It's not what I thought. They all look kind of. I thought there was going to be. I heard there was going to be dancers, showgirls.
That's why I'm here.
Is a little bit kind of. Yeah. There's just a fucking baby. Like that's it. There's just a baby. We're supposed to come and just look at a baby. Really, that's. What the? That's it. There's no strippers. Like, oh fuck. Yeah. Well, whatever. Yeah. I can tell already this Christianity thing is going to be as boring as fuck.
Boring.
Yeah. Well, we could have really done something with this, but
we had an opportunity.
No. Yeah. You had to let the Christians get their hands on it. They ruin everything.
Fucking.
So Leonardo, but now look at Leonardo's adoration of the Magi. It's like a crazed mob scene.
Yes.
Yes, you've baby zombies. Yes, you've got Mary and baby Jesus in the middle. Right. One of the characters may be Joseph. It's not obvious,
yeah.
But there's a whole bunch of characters surrounding them, and then they don't look stately. I mean, yes, it's unfinished, but they're on their hands and knees.
Yeah.
Their faces are contorted. They're expressing sort of shock and bemusement and horror. Some of them are looking to the skies. One of them's pointing to the sky, maybe to the Star of Bethlehem, whatever the fuck that is. They're looking sort of some look happy, some look sad, some look scared, some look, quite frankly, terrified. Then in the background,
there's
a whole bunch of crazy shit going on in the background. There's other characters cavorting, dancing, maybe some devils. There's two horses with riders right in the background fighting swords and shields. I think they're fighting over baby Jesus's foreskin. I think the guy with the sword has just cut it off.
It's mine.
And the other one's trying to take it from him.
Yes. Thou shalt not have this foreskin. Sorry.
It's really quite chaotic. There seem to be there's the classic sort of broken down temple of Solomon, showing the old world that Jesus has come to replace. In that the front of that, climbing up the stairs, and in front of the stairs, there seem to be some like Greek nymphs or something there. Obviously, probably not happy about the fact that no one's going to pay attention to them anymore, Greek goddesses, Greek nymphs, because this baby is going to occupy everybody's attention from now on.
Yeah.
It's very chaotic, is my point. There's a hell of a lot of shit going on here. It's vastly different in conception to Botticelli's nice, staid, serene painting. If completed, this would have been glorious. I mean, it's glorious as it is, unfinished, but it really is quite dramatic compared to the previous adorations.
I do want to ask, and because you touched on this a second ago, it's like for all the different people, everybody's got a different emotion, a different reaction, a different level of intensity to whatever and however they're reacting. You could sit here, if you were standing in front of this in a museum, you could easily stand there for at least an hour trying to take it all in because there's so much that's different. Whereas in the Botticelli, like you said, it's, you know, they're all kind of stately there. They're all standing there. They're all dignified. And there's not a lot of difference here. I mean, there's like a whole bunch of different little stories inside this painting that you might not notice unless you stand there and peruse it for hours. And it is very intense for that reason. I mean, you could just spend the day there getting lost and trying to figure out what these people are feeling or thinking, because they definitely are experiencing different emotions from this is our Jesus. He's going to save us from everything. Everything's going to be fine now. I mean, these people are literally dealing with the concept that here is God incarnate in this baby, and it is an incredible moment. And they're all reacting differently, but intently to that idea.
Yeah. Now, there's a couple of things I want to point out. If people are playing at home, bring up a high-resolution image of it. Google Art Project's got a good one. If you look at there's two trees in the center, supposedly representing new life, Mary and Jesus, something, something, something. The main one, the big one, has a root, quite a big root, coming down And it looks like it goes behind Jesus's head and then ends up wrapping around his arm. It's connected to his outstretched hand.
Yeah.
See that?
Right about he's middle.
He's being rooted by this tree. Yes. Now, this is like maybe the tree of life. It's connected to him. You know, we've seen before in other paintings, there's something about Jesus' blood you often see in Renaissance paintings at the foot of the tree because his blood is going to soil the earth or some bullshit.
In a good way.
Yeah. And then if you look where his outstretched hand is, there's a guy, one of the three kings, kneeling in front of him, now holding one of the gifts out to him, which Jesus is like, yeah, fuck, I'll take that. Thanks very much. I needed some myrrh.
You can't have enough myrrh. Yeah.
You never can have enough myrrh. Now, it took me a long time to figure out what the fuck's going on with this guy's head. It looks to me at first instance that his mouth is distorted and wide open and he's vomiting some like food out of, or he's eating a piece of bread or an apple.
Right.
He's like, sorry, Jesus, I was just in the middle of my lunch when
I didn't know you were going to turn to me. Yeah, yeah.
I saw this. didn't realize the time. I was like, oh shit, I got that Jesus thing. But I'm hungry.
It's my tuna belt.
I'll just finish my lunch. Jesus isn't going to care. But apparently, I'm not looking at it right. That's apparently his beard, not food that he's putting in his mouth. It looks to me like the way his hand is positioned, it looks like his hand is holding that thing and putting it into his open mouth. But apparently, that's his beard.
Yeah, his chin is up higher than I originally assumed. Okay, all right.
Yeah.
All right. I
spent a crazy amount of time looking at that, trying to figure out what the fuck was going on. And somebody, one of my old high school buddies actually said, no, it's just his beard. And I was like, oh, yeah, so it is. It's just a beard. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Now, I want to talk about the three kings, Ray. I think I've mentioned the three kings before.
You seem to find them fascinating. Yeah, go ahead.
I do. Like all this stuff, it's fascinating. Now, you were a Catholic once. Tell me what you know about the three kings.
I've heard
the three wise men.
I've heard wise men. I really don't know a lot. They were following the star that was supposed to lead them to Jesus, and some things claim king, some claim either wise men or not scientists, but knowledgeable men, and they were just following the star to go find the baby Jesus to worship at his feet, bring him gifts, and let him know, hey, you got a friend in me.
Now, it may or may not surprise people to know that the three kings or the three wise men are never mentioned in the Bible as such.
Right.
Matthew is the only one of the four Gospels that mention the Magi at all. And here's what it says. I'll read it from Matthew. In the time of King Herod, after Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea, wise men from the east came to Jerusalem asking, where is the child who has been born king of the Jews? For we observed his star at its rising and have come to pay him homage. When King Herod heard this, he was frightened, and all Jerusalem with him, and calling together all the chief priests and scribes of the people, he inquired of them where the Messiah was to be born. They told him, in Bethlehem of Judea, for so it has been written by the prophet. And you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah, for from you shall come a ruler who is to shepherd my people Israel. Then Herod secretly called for the wise men and learned from them the exact time when the star had appeared. Then he sent them to Bethlehem, saying, go and search diligently for the child, and when you have found him, bring me word so that I may also go and pay him homage.
Aww.
When they had heard the king, they set out, and there, ahead of them, went the star that they had seen at its rising, until it stopped over the place where the child was. When they saw that the star had stopped, they were overwhelmed with joy. On entering the house, they saw the child with Mary, his mother, and they knelt down and paid him homage. Then, opening their treasure chests, they offered him gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. And having been warned in a dream not to return to Herod, they left for their own country by another path.
Oh, don't trust the king.
Now,
yes,
so many fucking problems with this. Like, A, King Herod would give a shit what some guys from the wise men from the east said.
Right.
B, that he would ask them where the Messiah was to be born, because I don't think King Herod really believed in a Messiah. He was the king of the Jews at the time. Messiah was supposed to be the king of the Jews. He was the king of the Jews. He's like, well, bitch, I am the Messiah.
Yeah.
And, you know, the whole traveling star stopped over the top of a house, really. That's not how stars work. Hello, newsflash. So
Bill
what
Nye,
the fuck
the
is that
guy
all about?
Told us that. Yeah.
But there's no mention of them being three kings. There's no mention of there being three of them.
Right.
Matthew just says wise men from the east came.
Oh.
Doesn't call them three. Apparently, so what happens is a couple of things here. Because he said they brought three gifts.
Oh, deduction.
Frankincense, myrrh, and a Tesla. that it's been Christians later assumed that there were three. Now, Matthew actually calls them magi in the Greek. The word magi is the plural of the Latin magus, borrowed from the Greek magos or magos.
Right.
And the Greek text of Matthew, he says magoi in the plural. Greek magos is actually derived from the old Persian magus or magus, which was a religious caste in Zoroastrianism in Persia. Zoroaster himself was born into the caste of the magus or magus, the magi.
Okay.
So it was a religious caste, a priestly caste of Zoroastrians. Got nothing to do with Jews. So why the fuck would Zoroastrians from Persia give a fuck about a little Jewish baby?
Makes
zero sense.
You said this was what little there is in the book of Matthew. I think Matthew did not do his due diligence on Wikipedia before he wrote this, got a lot of facts wrong, and then the church has to work with what they have and they spin their story.
Now, as part of their religion, the Zoroastrian priests paid a lot of attention to astronomy. They were famous. We've talked about this, I remember, in our Alexander series.
Yeah.
They were famous for their knowledge of astronomy. They took it seriously, and it was regarded, rightly so, as a science in Alexander's day, and also supposedly when Jesus was born. And the Zoroastrian priests were considered, you know, the world global experts in astronomy. So if anyone in that era knew that stars don't stop over the fucking top of tents or mangers, it's going to be your Zoroastrian magi priests.
Right.
They're like, boss, that's not how the fucking stars. We've been studying them for hundreds of years, and that's definitely not how they work.
Just read my dissertation when I got my PhD. That's exactly, ironically, what it's about. They don't move like that. Sorry.
Yeah.
Sorry to disappoint.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This whole thing that they believe that there was a star that appeared and followed a baby, no.
Yeah.
No. They're not saying that at all.
Right. God can do anything. Yes, he probably didn't. That's all I'm saying.
And they believed in a different god. They worshipped the Hurul Mazda, not Yahweh, the minor god of the Jews. Now, because their religious practices and use of astrology was similar to a lot of peasant, in the minds of a lot of peasant people at the time, as being magic.
Right.
And the occult in general, term magi ended up being tied to the English word magic.
Oh, look at the rabbit. Sorry.
Magi, magus. And of course, and this is going down another rabbit hole, but in the New Testament, there is mention of Simon Magus.
Right.
You ever heard of Simon Magus?
I've heard don't know shit.
He turns up in some extra biblical literature as well, but I think in the Bible he's recorded in the book of Acts, where supposedly Peter, after Jesus is dead, Peter hears about this guy, Simon Magus, or Simon the Sorcerer, Simon the Magician.
Right.
He was a Messiah, messianic candidate himself. Went to the Christians and because he heard that they were doing huge magic tricks, and he was like, "I want in on this." And he offered to buy his way in.
Oh yeah.
And Peter said, "No, fuck you, dude. You can't buy your way into this." So Simon challenged him to a magic duel.
God damn, I love the story. Love it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I don't think that version's in Acts. I think that's another biblical story or extra biblical story.
Right.
In the extra biblical story, I think it's the Acts of Peter or something like that. He challenges him to a magic duel, and Simon flies up into the air with the power of his magic.
And some rope. Tied to a tree.
To demonstrate how good he is. And Peter goes, like one of the priests in Age of Empires. And Simon falls out of the sky and breaks his legs. And people are like, oh, shit, Peter's magic's better than your magic.
Oh, snap, motherfucker. Oh my God!
Yeah.
I would have loved.
So that's
the
second appearance of a magus in,
right.
And that's also I think why it ended up being tied to magic and the occult in the Western world because
Who's
he was magic.
Who in the fuck is?
Yeah,
that?
I know.
Paint that shit.
Paint that
awesome.
Shit. Yeah. I kind of want to make a movie about Simon Magus, his story.
Our next
movie.
Yeah, badass.
Now, the Magi referred to as kings or wise men in Christian tradition, but there's nothing in Matthew's account that suggests either of those things. They're Magi.
Right.
But the problem is that, you know, Christians would have struggled even back then.
Oh, yeah.
Stone
them.
Well, a couple of Zoroastrian priests... were the first guys.
Right.
The first guys to recognize the baby Jesus was special. It wasn't Jews.
And who told them?
It was Persian Zoroastrian priests.
Right.
Even you know, illiterate, uneducated Christians in, you know, the 2nd, 3rd, 4th century CE would have gone, oh, hold on a second.
That's right.
What?
That's not
That
kosher.
Doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
What the fuck are you talking about? So easier just to call them wise men or kings and just fudge the details and hope nobody pays any attention. Now, there's also no mention, obviously, in Matthew of their names, but Christian tradition, which originated around 500 CE, calls them Melchior, Caspar, and Balthazar.
Right?
Because, look, if you're gonna make shit up, might as well go all the way.
Turn it up to 11. Yeah.
Make them kings, give them names, give them backstories.
Yes.
Oh, I remember that time that I was drinking with Balthazar at the bar in Mos Eisley, and he was trying to rent a fast starship, and I said my starship did the Kessel Run in 21 parsecs, 12 parsecs, and he was like, parsecs? That's not even a speed, you idiot. That's a unit of distance. You don't even know what you're talking about.
Oh,
did we laugh? And then, you know,
it's magic.
Then, you know, he shot Greedo, and then Greedo shot him first. And these are not the Magi you're looking for, we said to stormtroopers as we left. Fucking this is
Christianity, right there.
Christianity in a nutshell, right there. This story,
you should just record, snip that part out, and that's your Christianity.
Yeah. Now, we don't know that how many of them there were. There might have been 20 of them, right. But only three took gifts. And the rest were like gifts for a Jewish baby. What the fuck is baby going to do with myrrh? Are you insane? I think the fact that we're traveling for months through deserts to be there on a fucking camel, no less, dust storms, following an imaginary star is enough. It should be enough. If that's not enough, then seriously, he can go fuck himself. Like, we aren't even Jews or Christians. We're Persians, for fuck's sake. Why should we bring gifts?
Yeah. Scorpions, snakes, why am I risking my life? What am I getting out of this?
For some fat Jewish illegitimate baby. Like, seriously?
Yeah.
I can't believe you talked me into this, quite frankly. Right. I don't know why I never signed up for this.
Well, and the greatest thing is that actually the baby is the product of a rape. No one wants to bring it up, but I said it.
That's the only reason they were going. He's a rape baby. And they were like,
is he part black?
They felt sorry for him.
Yeah. I just want to see the baby.
It's black. Yeah. Now, in Eastern Christianity, and particularly in the Syriac churches, the Magi are often numbered 12. They were 12 Magi who went, and only three took gifts, and the other nine were like, fuck him. No, we're not taking gifts. Look, if he survives till his 21st, I'll buy him a beer. But honestly,
till then.
Like, mortality rates at this stage, he's probably not going to survive six months. And listen, anyone who has a star following him around doesn't need our shit.
Yeah, they're good.
He can multiply loaves and fishes. I mean, what does he need? He can just make. He can bring people back from the dead, or he's going to be able to. What the fuck does he need frankincense and myrrh for? Like, honestly. Now, apparently, there was an Iranian legend concerning Magi and a star, which was connected to a Persian belief, a legend, a myth, that a star would rise to predict the birth of a ruler. And that this ruler would be a manifestation of a divine figure, Ahura Mazda, and would come with fire and light. Matthew, it would appear, heard that story and just went, stealing that. Yeah. That's good. I'm using that.
That's right. It's going in. Yeah.
Yeah.
Tweak it here and there. It's going in. I'm going to sell a ton of books, more than Harry Potter.
And as people who have seen my film know, most biblical scholars today will say that the order that the Gospels were written in is Mark, Matthew, Luke, and John. There's some debate over the order of Matthew and Luke. And the general consensus is, although there is some debate, but the general consensus is that Mark was written first, Matthew and Luke copied from Mark, or Matthew copied from Mark and then Luke copied from Matthew. And John just did his own thing. He was high on crack and wrote his own thing, which is completely different. But the general consensus is, and Mark is the shortest and the most boring, and Jesus it's just a guy who walks in off the street one day and says, you know what, maybe we shouldn't, maybe we should love each other. And people went, you're fucking crazy, and he got killed. And he didn't return from the dead.
Right.
Hold
of it.
Then Matthew got a hold of it. He's the original Hollywood. Right. And he went, no, this is way too boring. We need to sex this up.
Three acts.
So
three acts.
Matthew, three kings.
Right.
Matthew puts the wise men in it. Matthew puts the Sermon on the Mount. Matthew puts the virgin birth. Matthew puts the rising from the dead. Matthew puts all of this stuff in it. Matthew's the guy that sexes it up.
Good for him.
Now, the very fact that this story is obviously bullshit and that it's been taken from an Iranian legend, a Persian legend, quite obviously says to me that Matthew is full of shit. That in and of itself, and as well as the whole thing I actually do talk about in the film, my producers said I didn't have time to go into the Three Kings story, which was in the original version of the script. But I did manage to keep the whole Barabbas thing, which is obviously also a bullshit story when you unpick it. Anywho, the three gifts, by the way, have a spiritual meaning. Gold is a symbol of kingship on earth. Frankincense is a symbol of deity.
Oh,
because it's incense. You can't see it. It just smells good, like God. You can't right. see him. He just smells nice. And myrrh is an embalming oil, which is a symbol of death. So he's going to be a king, he's a god, and he's going to die. That's what the three gifts. I mean, if anyone's thinking of going to a baby shower and taking gold, frankincense, and myrrh.
Last one.
Yeah, not, not,
not cool.
Not appreciated, not cool. Hey, he's going to die one day. I just think he needs to know
I'm just
that.
Calling you on it and being real. Yeah. 100% real, yeah. Oh, my God. So, should we go into any of Leo's preparatory works, what he did?
Yes. Knock yourself out.
Okay. So, he does start to make drawings. He does follow what Alberti said, which is when you draw the human body, first you draw the skeleton, then you draw the skin, and then you draw the clothes. And so when you look at his drawing that has survived here, a lot of these people do look like skeletons or zombies. It's kind of crazy. So I think it's worth remembering that, like you were saying 20 minutes ago, we think of, at this stage, we're thinking of Leonardo as an artist. One of the many videos that I watched said, no, don't think of him as a painter. Think of him as an architect or a draftsman or whatever, but who just happens to be doing painting right now. So Leonardo is going to go into great detail to have a mathematically delineated, precise lines to organize his picture here, because like you said, he's going to initially have like 60 people in this, and that's just way too much. So it's going to get cut in half. But what it is it's art that is hung on the frame of science. So he has his assistants make this large panel, 8 foot squared with 10 planks of poplar wood. He has them put up, and we can go into this or not, because I know we're getting close to time, but there's a traditional method of getting the people that's going to be in your painting onto the wood, but Leo's going to do his own thing, and the reason he makes his own changes is because he wants to be ready to change a gesture, a look of movement, or whatever, until he has actually got it on the board. He wants to keep his options open, so he's getting ready to transfer it to the wood. And the Uffizi Museum, they did infrared scans, ultraviolet scans, high resolution scans, so they can see the steps that he took. So he draws his lines of perspective. He has it all planned out. And as he starts going, and I'm going to kind of do the short version of this, but as he's organizing his picture and as he's coming up with these paintings, he's taking his own advice that where he says, no two people should have the same expression on their face. No two people should be making the same movement at a time. So as he's doing this and his people gets cut down from 60 to 30, he's like putting it all together. He's drawing the sketches right onto the panel. And he's like, oh my God, I have to draw light, shadow, perspective, different emotions, different reactions, different movements for all 30 people. Because the only one who's going to be still and calm is Mary and the baby. And so the idea of trying to draw the light coming from a certain direction, which is going to bounce off this cloak, or it's going to bounce off this person or this horse, and it's going to affect the person next to them. I think he just started going down a rabbit hole. He's like, in my mind, this makes sense, but how am I supposed to possibly execute this with 30 people on this 8x8 paneling? And so I think at some point his brain kind of locks up. His imagination and his ambition were in one place, but his ability to manifest that, I don't think could match it. And so at some point, I think he just like freezes up and he doesn't know how to proceed.
Like you in the bedroom.
Pretty much. 2 minutes.
He did lots of studies for it, which have survived. They're in various museums around the world. Some historians think he might have done hundreds of preparatory sketches. He ended up breaking the canvas, or the wood, actually. As you said, it's about 8 foot square, this wood panel, 2.5 meters square. breaking it into two triangles whose apexes meet in the middle where Mary's head is. Wow. Then he drew a bunch of other triangles and moved them all slightly, interrupting them with verticals here and there so the picture wouldn't be overly symmetrical because he didn't want it to look too neat.
Right.
Then all the perspective lines, and these were on the preparatory drawings. Now, what he would normally do is prick the preparatory drawing with a needle, mm-hmm. and then put it over the wood or the canvas, and then put dots on all of the prick holes.
Right.
So he had like an outline to work with, but he didn't do that in this case. He sketched a new version directly onto the wood.
Yeah.
He was that confident at that stage that he knew what he wanted, that he was able to just redraw it. Then he treated that with a white primer coat, and that became his underdrawing. Then he put a nail near the center of the panel, right in what is the trunk of the tree, attached a string to it so he could draw the perspective lines with a fine stylus into the white priming coat. And if you see the preparatory drawing with the perspective lines, it's incredible. Like, he drew a million of them. Like, he's not fucking around here.
Right.
He's, like, his preparation to do this is really detailed and insane. Then he drew the architectural background, the ruined Roman palace, which, as I said before, supposedly symbolizes the crumbling of paganism. Then when he'd done the background, he started to work on the human figures. He used fine-tipped black chalk to lightly sketch the outlines. He did that so he could revise them and retouch them if he changed his mind about the emotions or the gestures that they were displaying. Once he had done that, he covered it all with a thin layer of white primer.
Wow.
And then he slowly started to paint. Mm-hmm. Now, as you say, it seems that there's a variety of theories for reasons why he may not have finished it.
Right.
One might have been that it was too hard, and he was such a perfectionist, and he realized he didn't yet have the skill to complete it. I heard a quote last night. My son Hunter said it to me.
Mm-hmm.
Was it Hunter? No. Fuck, what was that I was listening to? Oh, it was somebody talking about David Lynch. Richard Oyoide, I think, talking about David Lynch, saying that he heard it. Somebody said the definition of a genius is somebody who can accurately create the vision they have in their mind.
Mm.
And most of us can't.
Right. Right.
And Da Vinci, maybe he just went like, "Wow, like too hard. I can't. Yeah. I don't want to do anything lesser.
Yeah,
but I can't do this.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah."
So many people, so many facial expressions, so many gestures, so much going on. So the light and the optics, as you said, involved in that. Way too hard, and he couldn't work out to do it. Art historian Francesca Fiorani said he must have faltered at the thought of how to balance the reflections that bounce from one figure to another and to control the myriad variables of light, shade, and emotions for such a multitude. Unlike any other artist, he could not ignore an optical problem. Yeah. He wasn't prepared to go, look, you know, good enough is good enough. You know,
yeah.
Perfect is the enemy of good. Let's face it, you know, no one's going to know. We'll just do it. Just whack it out there, you know.
But he could.
No, not good enough for Leonardo.
Right.
Another theory.
Yeah.
Sorry.
No. Just that, again, I don't think his skill at this time could match his imagination. I think she nailed it. Because he'd studied optics for so long, he could not fudge it. He could not fake it. Look, I can't do it, and so I'm not going to. But again, he had to get this far in the drawings to figure out that it was too daunting of a task.
Another theory is the reason he didn't complete the painting is he preferred thinking about paintings to actually doing them.
Yeah.
Like, he liked the planning stages of paintings, lots of preparatory sketches.
Yeah.
The actual doing of it is like, not my cup of tea.
Can I get an assistant?
Really, quite frankly.
Yeah.
I've worked out how to do it. That's enough. Yeah. I don't need to
Yeah.
I designed a bicycle and a helicopter, motherfuckers. I'm not actually going to build them.
No.
Yeah, let that other people can do that. Yeah. I like to think about.
I'm R&D,
big things.
Research and research and development, but I don't actually build it. That's not my thing.
And less of the development, really.
Yeah,
just
really.
The research.
Just cut that off.
Yeah.
Just cut it off.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm R&D. Right. Just R&D.
And could you not actually pay me in wood? I'd really appreciate it if you didn't pay me in wood.
He was R&D, but the D stood for dick. And it was rectum and dick. That's really what he's.
I researched dick.
Yeah,
that's pretty much my thing.
Look, nobody knows more about dick than I do.
That's right. And I can never learn enough. Yeah.
Leonardo da Dick, man. That's what they call me. You know, maybe his father in the monastery knew that when they drafted the contract because he hadn't started or finished the earlier works. You know, he liked to talk about doing things rather than do them.
Oh.
And in that way, he also reminds me of you,
thank you.
Ray. Except for the genius part.
Right.
If only Leonardo had YouTube to quickly bone up on a couple of things without actually having to do any work.
Oh.
Who knows what would have happened in the Renaissance.
Could have been even better.
7 months after he was commissioned to create the painting, his payments, the small amount of money they'd agree to pay him when it was obvious he was too broke to pay the dowry or for his own paints, ended. There's no more mention of him in the monastery's records.
Right.
He had stopped work and, in fact, he had left Florence with his boy toys for greener pastures. And if people remember, in the very first episode of the Leonardo series, I read out his job application that he sent to the Duke of Milan.
Right.
Well, apparently he got a positive reply to that because he packed up his firewood and his dicks and toy boys.
Sticks and dicks, right?
Sticks and dicks. And he left for, it's literally what I have written in my notes. He packed up his sticks and dicks and left for Milan.
See ya. Yeah.
He left the unfinished painting with his friend Giovanni de Benci, the brother of Ginevra de Benci.
Right.
And the monks of San Donato immediately commissioned Botticelli's protege, Filippino Lippi, the illegitimate son of Filippo Lippi and the nun that he fucked and ran off with.
Yeah, he did.
To paint a substitute, which he did, and they hung that proudly in their monastery.
God. This is, I guess this is this Leo's potentially low point in his life, or was maybe that was the last 5 years, but this certainly is a low point for him. His third commission, didn't finish it, embarrassed his father, let him down, his father's bending over backwards, and now he has skipped town with his third unfinished commission. Who knows what's going to happen from here?
I don't remember him putting that in his job application to the Duke of Milan, by the way. Yeah. Listen, I'm the greatest, one of the great, I am the greatest painter alive today.
When I finish.
Not so great at finishing them, but
huge
you know, if I did finish it.
Oh, it'd be fucking awesome.
Yeah.
Now, what about the historian that said even this unfinished work enhanced his reputation? So I guess if his friend Giovanni's got it, maybe people saw it or some people saw about it and they talked about it or commented on it or put it in letters. I don't know. But supposedly, even though he didn't finish this, people were going, wow, I can see what he was going for. And it would have been incredible. Is that a compliment?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely what happened. Not just then, but it obviously survived through to this very day. And a lot of people, I think, in the Renaissance who came after Leonardo saw it, including Michelangelo, and went, holy shit, that's something. Look at what he was going for then. That is ambitious. The very fact that he's attempting that.
Right.
We all need to lift our game, and that's what they did. But, my friend, that is the end of this episode. When we come back next time, Leonardo will be in Milan hitting his stride.